From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Over the last decade, the foreign-born population in Mexico has nearly doubled, and the country is turning into an immigrant destination. I'll talk with University of Oklahoma Latin America scholar Alan McPherson about the new dynamics of migration in our southern neighbor.
Mexico has never been a place that was hostile to immigrants. In fact, people from Latin America have always gone to Mexico to find freedom, especially in Mexico City.
And later, I'm joined by environmental journalist Emma Maris. She writes about assisted migration, deliberately helping plants and animals colonize new habitats.
Doing something like that would not have occurred to most environmentalists because it's not putting it back. But in this sort of world of 2013, moving something might be the best way to save it.
When wild nature and human management meet. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. Alan McPherson, thank you for joining me today.
You're very welcome.
So I was intrigued by this recent article in the New York Times, actually it was last Sunday's New York Times, about Mexico. And it was a little different narrative than what we hear about Mexico often, what we see and hear about Mexico in the press and the media. You know, we hear about violence and drug wars and all kinds of, you know, people leaving Mexico, flocking to the United States and elsewhere. But this article would lead us to believe that Mexico is indeed very vibrant. It's kind of rising as a cultural center in Latin America. South Koreans flocking, Europeans flocking to Mexico. What are we to make of that? I mean, is this your sense? This is your part of the world. You've been there. What do you think about it?
Well, my sense is that the article pointed to important trends, but they've got to be put into context. I mean, clearly what's happening in Mexico is that Mexico is globalizing, right? It has embraced free trade almost completely, and it is globalizing in ways good and bad. And the article tends to focus on the good and the new, which is fantastic because you have a lot of immigrants. They are finding it relatively easy to do business in Mexico. They're finding that there's a lot of creative energy in Mexico, which I think is all true. I mean, Mexico has never been a place that was hostile to immigrants. In fact, people from Latin America have always gone to Mexico to find freedom, especially in Mexico City, which is really different from the rest of the country. And so in those ways, I think the article gets it right. In other ways, you know, we have to put this into sort of a different context, which is that there's still a relatively small number of immigrants in Mexico. I think the article says it's about 1%. In the United States, the percentage is far higher, 5, 6% are foreign born.
Although they note that they think that that's undercounting somehow, that they're not all being represented there, and that in their mind it could be as high as 3% or more. But nonetheless growing, right, in a trend. It's trending upward in Mexico.
That's right, yeah. And I think the trend is probably right, whereas the United States is more of a stagnating economy and a sort of a culturally probably also stagnating, whereas Mexico is much more vibrant. And also you're seeing more of a diversification of what Mexico is. And so the economy is more diverse than it ever was. But of course, there are great losers in this globalization, and that those are the people not particularly mentioned. There's an allusion to the fact that, you know, not all is rosy in the Mexican economy. And of course, NAFTA, other free trade, other aspects of globalization have created a lot of losers in Mexico, and they're not really in this article. You know, these people don't leave, or, you know, they're not immigrants. The winners are the immigrants, and those are the people interviewed in the article. But the losers often have to leave Mexico. They end up in the United States. Sometimes they have to go back to Mexico, and so they're not considered the very innovative or creative people, but they're a very large proportion of the population. They're the poor of Mexico, whose lives, they would say, have been made much more difficult by free trade and by globalization.
So it's a mixed message, or a mixed bag, I guess, is the more accurate way of looking at Mexico, because you have – and I think the article did suggest that, you know, there's still a significant amount of inequality, and that these – you mentioned the capital, for example, which is very different, and they said the main population centers, so Mexico City, maybe Monterrey, Guadalajara, that these are really the vibrant places, and that if you get outside of those areas, then you have a relatively, you know, different picture.
Right. I think you have two kinds of pockets of this sort of globalization or diversification. You have some of the big urban centers, and you also have sort of smaller towns like San Miguel de Allende that have always welcomed exiles, a lot of Americans. And those are vibrant in their own way, but they're more sort of smaller rural places.
So I thought it was interesting that they made some reference to how the United States and Europe, people consider them to be spiritually dead. You know, they're too commercial and materialistic. I think there's some truth to that, perhaps, meaning in comparison maybe in terms of the youth, right? Because we're talking about – this is a young country in the sense that you've got a lot of – the demographics. You have a lot of young people, and it's you know, drawing in young people. So is that perhaps the significant difference, is just that demographic and the vibrancy, the energy? It all really relates to just the youth of Mexico.
Well, I think that's a certain part of it. I mean, the United States population is getting older, and interestingly, it's the immigrants to the United States that are making the population not age as quickly. Europe doesn't have as many immigrants, and so it's aging even more quickly. China's actually aging quite quickly. China's also part of this story in Mexico, because one of the reasons that there are globalization winners in Mexico is because goods coming from China are more and more expensive. Salaries are going up in China. Transportation costs are much higher from China than from Mexico. And so to a certain extent, Mexico is benefiting from trends that have nothing to do with Mexico. They're sort of these global trends.
Well, it is interesting to see a little different take on what we normally perceive about our neighbors to the south, about Mexico, the country. And certainly the problems clearly remain. But I guess the long-term question for us to consider in the future is this a short-term trend, or is this going to be a long-term trend? And to what extent, will Mexico continue to grow and attract people from all around the world?
That's true. I mean, what we hear mostly about is the drug war, the violence that accompanies it. And these are very serious problems. But again, you have to see the drug war within a very complex country. I mean, there's more than 100 million people in Mexico. The drug war is mostly concentrated in the north, in a couple of towns on the coasts. Mexico City has largely been free of direct drug war violence. And so hopefully this trend will continue and will affect more Mexicans in a positive way.
Well, very interesting. Alan McPherson, thank you so much for being with us today.
Welcome.
And we have a link to that New York Times article we've been talking about on our website, kgou.org. While you're there, you can also leave a comment about this discussion or find a link to our Twitter feed at WorldViewsKGOU. After a short break, I'll talk with environmental journalist Emma Maris about modernizing the idea of conservation. I'm Suzek Rolat, and you're listening to Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. My guest, Emma Maris, is a freelance environmental writer based in Columbia, Missouri. The Economist called her 2011 book, Rambunctious Garden, an insightful analysis of the thinking that informs nature conservation. She worked as a staff writer at the science journal Nature for several years, and recently she's been experimenting with blogging about small nature she encounters in urban settings. We have a link to her Tumblr page, Everyday Nature, on our website, kgou.org. Emma Maris, welcome to Worldviews.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're a writer, and you've covered a lot of interesting topics and published in various areas, ranging from energy issues, agriculture, food, language, film, all kinds of things. But what seems to kind of unify, that unifying theme in your work seems to be the environment, a focus on the environment. Can you tell us a little bit about what your focus is in that regard?
Sure. I was for many years a staffer at the scientific journal Nature. So I covered the sort of science of the environment, ecology, conservation biology, and other fields that directly deal with environmental issues. In 2007, I went freelance, and I've been writing about the environment in various magazines and journals since then. And then in 2011, I came out with a book, Rambunctious Garden, which is about how to do conservation in the modern era.
So what do you mean by that, conservation in the modern era? I mean, we're all quite familiar with things like reuse, recycle, reduce.
Right.
Is this not what we should be doing now, or should we be doing something different?
I think these are all good strategies. What I became really interested in was about, so let's say we are doing the right things and we're pulling, as it were, less aggressively on the natural resources of the planet, so that there's land out there that we are not using for our own, as a farm or as a timber plantation. What do we do with those natural areas out there? How do we manage them? In the past, what we've tended to do is focus a lot on parks and wilderness areas as a sort of the core concern of conservation. And what my book is about is expanding that out. So we keep our parks, we keep our natural areas and we keep our wildernesses, but we also start to think about how to do conservation in more unfamiliar places, like on farms or in cities. How can we invite nature into those spaces? And how do we manage our parks and our cities and all our different spaces? In the past, we tended to try to put them back the way they used to be. We have this kind of sense that people mess things up and the best way to take care of the earth is to put it back the way it used to be. But the problem is that's not really necessarily working very well anymore. The climate is changing. Land use is changing all that's around us. Species are being moved around. So in this kind of crazy, mixed up, heating up world, it's getting harder and harder to put things back the way they used to be. Sometimes it's become impossible. So in that world, how do you do conservation? The book's about trying to do things with land, trying to encourage nature that doesn't look like it did in the past, that's sort of new. A little bit new, subtly new, but slightly new. So some of the strategies I talk about in the book are things like assisted migration, which is a kind of a catchphrase for, let's say the climate is heating an area up, climate change is happening, and there's a species that cannot survive this new hotter climate. Assisted migration would take that species and actually move it to a place where it can survive better, a place that it maybe had never been before. So in the older conception, doing something like that would not have occurred to most environmentalists because it's not putting it back. It's making something new and different. But in this sort of world of 2013, moving something might be the best way to save it.
So it's trying to preserve what we have, but do it in a way that maybe, as you said, can different from the way we've done it before, that instead of trying to save a certain habitat in a certain location, we just relocate their habitat?
Sure. I mean, yeah. One way to put it is one of the scientists I interviewed for the book said that she as the world changes, she's less concerned about where things are and more concerned that they just exist.
Okay.
So a lot of it is about reassessing some of our kind of deeply held notions about invasive species, for example. A lot of non-native species can be really destructive, but some of them aren't that destructive. And if we spend some of our scarce resources trying to remove non-native species that aren't actually causing any harm, I think it would be a better use of that money to protect more land from development, for example. So these are pretty subtle shifts, but they're shifts that have been kind of controversial within the conservation community, with people arguing vociferously on both sides. So it's been an interesting time, having written the book, to be in part of these ongoing conversations about whether we should continue to focus on putting things back or whether we should be trying to manage to some new future condition.
But the assumption here, then, is clearly that humans are changing nature.
Right.
And so that what we're doing, human behavior, is contributing to a change in the natural world.
Right.
I think you've talked about the humanization of the planet or of nature.
Right.
So this is just one way to basically deal with that rather than changing our behavior. Are these things that come in tandem?
They're complementary, absolutely. I mean, I think part of what's going on within the conservation community is this realization about the massive scope of our influence over the planet. You know, we've turned up the temperature. We've moved everything around. We have changed. Something like 75% of the ice-free land is now under direct human use. That means it's either grazing land, agricultural land, or developed land. 13% of the planet is protected areas. That's not a whole lot of real estate. We're increasingly living on an Earth that's sort of defined by how we're using it. So if we are only focusing on those 13% of areas that are in parks, we're not getting the full bang for our buck here as far as conservation. We need to be doing conservation, increasing biodiversity, all this stuff in all these other places like cities and so on. And at the same time, we do need to be trying to arrange our own lives, both on a personal level and also through policies, laws, and so on, so that we don't pull as hard on the resources of the planet.
My guest is Emma Maris, a freelance environmental journalist and the author of the 2011 book, Rambunctious Garden. She'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Let's get back to my conversation with environmental journalist Emma Maris. When we left off, she argued conservation could be more efficient if people worked harder to integrate environmentalism into their daily lives. So we still need to reduce, reuse, recycle.
Absolutely.
All the things that
we're not off the hook on that.
Yeah, to conserve the planet and conserve resources and that sort of thing, but that we can do that within the context of adjusting our
relationship with nature as needed in terms of relocation and thinking
about it
differently.
You know, and part of this might sound like it's a really sort of abstract academic thing about, like, how do we manage these lands? Most of us are not land managers. It's not our day-to-day job to do that. But it does – this kind of shift in thinking does affect us normal people too, because, for example, one thing is it helps us sort of reclaim the nature that's all around us and start paying more attention to the nature in our own backyards, on our own city streets. There has been a tendency, I think, for people to think that the only really good nature is this sort of pristine, unspoiled place that they might see on a nature documentary, and then not really have a relationship with the grasshoppers outside and the trees that are growing and the little land snails in the garden and so on. And yet those relationships, I think, are going to be the foundation of sort of the future environmental ethic as new children grow up. So there's that, and then there's opportunities to actually sort of do conservation in your own yard. There's cool projects, like there's one in Seattle called The Path of the Pollinator, where a whole bunch of houses in a row have agreed to plant in their parking strips. I don't know what you call them here.
The driveway?
It's the little piece of green in between the sidewalk and the street. What do you call that in Oklahoma?
Well, I guess we just call it part of our yard.
Yeah, so yeah. That little strip.
So the little strip that's between the sidewalk and the street.
Right.
Okay, but it's still part of your yard. It's a lawn.
It's usually a lawn. But in this case, what they've done is they've planted them out completely with these beautiful wildflowers that pollinators love. And they've all agreed to do this together as a unit, connecting two large parks. So this creates like a little road for the pollinators to go back and forth, the bees and the hoverflies and the butterflies, and it's called Path of the Pollinator. These little kind of efforts are not just symbolic. Like, in some cases, they can actually be pretty meaningful for conservation to do things in neighborhoods. So this is the kind of new thinking that I'm working with now.
Well, and clearly touches the issue that it's not – I mean, reduce, reuse, and recycle definitely reaches out to a particular individual's behavior. But what you're pointing out is that clearly we need to be thinking beyond our individual behavior.
Yeah.
And looking at it more collectively and what we can be doing together in neighborhoods, in communities, in cities and states and nations and regions. And globally, right? I mean, is this what you're getting at?
Yes, but one other thing on that point, which I think is really interesting, is the whole reduce, reuse, recycle mantra, as useful as it is for us to keep in mind, is mostly focused on how we act as consumers. It's sort of how we shop and how we buy things and how we don't buy things. And I think that people are kind of bored or offended almost when you tell them the only way that they can have a positive influence on the planet is by how they shop. Doing things like putting rare, threatened, or native species in your garden, or doing things like inviting wildlife into your space, doing things like working together on a local creek project, those kinds of things, or being an activist, actually trying to change some of these larger systems that are causing environmental problems, rather than just trying to purify your own eco-behavior into some kind of sainthood. I think that's where I'd like to see it going, becoming more of a community project.
Well, the subtitle of your book has a very interesting word here, and that is post-wild world.
Right.
What do you mean by the post-wild world?
In a way, I kind of wish the subtitle had said in a post-wilderness world, and that may seem like a kind of a small distinction. But I actually think that there's plenty of wildness out there. But what there isn't necessarily is pristine wilderness in the classic sense of a place untouched by humans. We don't have that anymore. Every place is touched by humans, either because we've introduced species, because we've cut the trees down, or kind of more quietly, more invisibly by climate change, persistent pollutants in the environment, things like that. There is no place, even Antarctica, that is free from our influence. So if you think that nature is only the untouched wilderness, then environmentalism is over and we've lost, because there is no more untouched wilderness. The new environmentalism needs to see nature more broadly. Nature is us and everything else in a big, glorious, green, flourishing profusion spilling out into our cities and into our streets.
So that would indicate that we need to be more one with nature, I guess.
And yeah,
the
exactly.
The fact that we can't see them as separate. But does this get to something you've also written about, for example, a subject called domesticating foxes, where you make an argument
I'd say this is a pretty unrelated journalistic project that I did many years ago, just writing about a fascinating experiment where they tried to learn a little bit about the genetic roots of domestication by actually seeking to domesticate foxes. I don't think we should be domesticating wild animals. I think we should let wild animals be wild.
So that's not part of the project, is to try to be more one in the sense that we bring various species and wild species and humans together to coexist.
Yeah. Although it can be tricky. I mean, I'm not saying it's easy. I mean, you start rearranging your garden to have a lot of wildness in it, you're also going to have a lot more ticks in your backyard. You know, there's trade-offs here. And you start rearranging city parks to be more biodiverse, they're also going to be – they might not feel quite as safe at night because they're going to be more bushy and overgrown. So there's interesting trade-offs here. But I think that philosophically what I'm advocating for is moving away from this notion that there's nature, and nature is everything that humans don't touch, and that as soon as a bad human touches it, then it's ruined forever. Because I think that that kind of dichotomy is not helping us out. What we need to have is a more collaborative relationship with nature. We need to accept the fact that humans have had this very large influence, whether we like it or not, and work with that. And we need to invite more nature into our lives.
So along those lines, this new environmentalism you're referring to and this notion that of a more collaborative relationship with nature, how is this gaining ground in the environmental movement? I mean, the environmental movement, if there is one, I mean, if there is any singular environmental – and I don't know that there is, to be honest.
Yeah, I'd say no.
It's all over the place. I mean, there are lots of different aspects of the environment in which people are moved to action on certain things. But how is this gaining any ground? I mean, are you really starting to get some response from people around the world about treating nature in a different way than we've kind of been conceiving of it in the past?
I'd say so. I mean, there have been other people besides myself who've sort of said, hey, you know, let's move away from this black and white nature over there, people over here thing, and let's start looking at this differently. And there's a sort of a pragmatic streak to it because it's about acknowledging our influence and then trying to figure out how we can best have a flourishing nature, not necessarily condoning our influence. I got to point that out. So, yeah, there's some other people. There's also a little bit of blowback from a more traditional kind of wilderness focused group that thinks that this is a dilution of the sort of original environmentalist message. So there's a vigorous period of self-reflection within the conservation movement, which I'm really excited to be a part of because I think that what's coming out of it is a lot of really productive discussions that hopefully will create a kind of environmentalism, if it even needs to be a separate thing, that has a broader constituency, that isn't just about rich people who like to go hiking, but that is something that people all around the world can be a part of, and not just the sort of leisured class that can enjoy wilderness as a sort of a sacred object.
Well, this definitely gives us something to think about. Emma Maris, thank you so much for being with us today on World Peace. You've been listening to my conversation with environmental journalist Emma Maris. You can read an excerpt of her book, Rambunctious Garden, and find a link to her Tumblr blog, Everyday Nature, on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies and KGOU. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, and Hillary Gibson prepared the research for this interview. For Alan McPherson, I'm Suzette Grelott.